Philosophy. Descartes. Debate. The Mep Report. Mep Report. Mep Report. The awesomest discussion podcast in the history of the human species.
Oh, yeah!
Let me tell you of an interview with an old man emu. He's got a beak and feathers and things, but the poor old fella ain't got no wings. Aren't you jealous of the wedge-tailed eagle? Well, the eagle's flying round and round to keep my 2 feet firmly on the ground. Now, I can't fly, but I'm telling you, I could run the pants off a kangaroo. But he can't fly, but I'm telling you, he can run the pants off a kangaroo.
Alrighty, so in that case, welcome to the Mep Report number 165. It is August 31st, 2020. I think we can clearly say, in all of history, the worst year of all recorded time.
The pandemic's over. We did it.
You know, 1120 was not great either, right? Like, I know people are just like, you know, back in 975. I'm like, listen, I don't know what to tell you, but all I know is in the last week, not only has so many things that we'll probably talk about tonight gone down, but Chadwick Boseman, the star of Black Panther, who's an amazing actor, passed away. This guy, Sir Ken Robinson, who I'm a huge fan of, who's this big education guy who was the one who gave TED Talks about schools killing creativity. He passed away.
And also Sir Cliff Robinson.
I was just going to say, Cliff Robinson of UConn fame, a UConn alum.
Right, UConn and Blazers. Yes. Oh, yep. Really? I was actually wondering if you overlapped.
Yeah, they won the NIT in 1989, and when he led them to that, and then I got there in 1990. And I remember it because I was in a mock trial semifinal round, actually. Okay. And I was sitting down and I saw someone in the audience in the back was listening on some Walkman and was pumping their fist because they were listening to UConn, which was going through this big whatever. So, So I was very sad. Also, John Thompson, the coach of Georgetown during the 80s, passed away. So, like, it's
crazy. A lot of undisclosed causes of death, which I don't know if that's like people not wanting to be part of COVID and like victim blaming of COVID deaths
or victim blaming COVID.
Is it more like if they don't have COVID, then it's not newsworthy and it's just someone died, but it wasn't the exciting.
It's just something I've noticed lately that during the pandemic, maybe it's just that so doggone many people are dying that like it's hard to keep up as journalists, but it's just been an interesting thing where I feel like
a ton of major celebrities died in 2019, but then we didn't have like a single culprit that we suspected every time someone passed away.
Sure. And Chadwick Boseman did not die of COVID. I mean, his was disclosed.
That was unbelievable.
But that was about the only thing that was disclosed.
He made like 7 movies while he was dealing with that, including Black Panther. Like, because he was diagnosed in 2016 and Black Panther is 2018. I was really struck by that and what, you know, and obviously what an incredible icon. I obviously can't understand the level of why that representation mattered. I can just understand that it did. And Black Panther was a good movie. So,
well, he also played like Jackie Robinson and James Brown.
Thurgood Marshall too. He was 43.
He was the guy to call on.
He was 43 also. You know what I didn't realize is that he, they said that he ended up going to this academy in the UK for acting and he couldn't afford to go when he got accepted. So Denzel Washington paid for it without telling anyone. And then later on, somehow it leaked and they like, not from him, like the school or something. He found out that's because Denzel Washington thought he was super talented and wanted him to. So it was wild. I mean,
he lived a charmed life right up until the end. When it was no longer that.
Then it was no longer charmed. I know. Yeah, so it has been quite a time. But how are you guys doing? How's life, Russ, Story? How are you?
Pretty good. Managing?
It's all right.
Pretty good. Like, you know, when you open saying this is the worst year ever, like, I think I've talked to you about this before.
Facetious, but.
Oh, come on, man. Go watch Toy Story. Toy Story. Are you watching Woody?
That always works. If I asked him what he's watching, he will sometimes go, but it didn't work.
Well, as we can see.
All right. Well, Russ has his hands full this year.
How are you doing, Stan?
Yes, I am doing okay. School just started again, so the year continues. The last year of my MFA, so which is final fine year. Until I have to look for a job, which will not be so great. But you know, we'll see. They're, you know, I've never really liked jobs anyway, so why have one? It's fine. Don't need a job.
Who needs a job these days?
Exactly. I mean, yeah. It's overrated. It's unimportant.
All the cool kids don't have jobs, so I mean.
Well, there you go. Exactly. So I'll be fine. But yeah, other than that, not too much to report. Been working on my thesis, trying to make that happen. So yeah.
So tell me what the basics are. What are you doing for your thesis? Like,
I am writing a book to my unborn child.
Oh, really?
Yes. That is the plan. Wow. So yeah, I'm excited about it.
That's cool.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's story. So some of the stuff, you know, it's combining things I've already written and gotten published, but a lot of new stuff. It's mostly new stuff. And even the stuff that's been published, there's kind of a new frame around it that is, you know, in dialogue with the child to be. So I'm excited about the theme, but, so I've been writing a lot this summer and that's been good. Like to write. Yeah, can't really complain. You know, and we've been staying inside the whole time. So
yeah,
that's,
and everyone's been inside without, you know.
Right, you know, occasionally getting groceries, occasionally walking on the path and dodging people who, and, you know, West Virginia University opened. We'll only have 472 cases on the first 4 days of class. That's it. No more than that. So
is that like the maximum number of students?
Yeah. So
100% infection rate.
Yeah. So we're doing just fine.
Just peachy.
And by just fine, I mean terrible. But better than Alabama, I guess. Jesus. I don't know. Or similar rate to Alabama, maybe just not actually as bad as Alabama in total. So, you know, I mean, I don't know if I ranted about this on the Met Report or not, but, you know, universities all did this kind of jointly, right? And they decided that, you know, universities are a little bit of a pyramid scheme. I mean, we love universities. Don't get me wrong. Universities are great. We both work for universities, Greg and I. But they're a little bit of a pyramid scheme in which you have to collect the meal and housing deposits. They massively overcharge freshmen and sophomores for meals and housing, and that keeps the entire university afloat.
Right.
And if you don't get that initial deposit, then all of the funds start to cascade downward. So I do believe that most universities, very cynically, in their heart of hearts, not too many people outside of the board of directors knew this, but most universities cynically said, we're going to get everybody in the dorms. They're all going to get a lot of COVID, but they're young and hopefully we won't have too many deaths and too much bad publicity. And then we're going to go all online week two or three for safety, but we will have warned them that this could happen. We've got their meal and housing deposits and not everything will fall apart.
Nice.
So that's underway here. It's happened at a lot of other places. Yeah. You know, so it's, I don't know, pretty tragic, pretty terrible. But
is it not the case that a lot of people are they offering online courses or is it only available if you're
on campus? It's about a third in, so it was initially, their initial plan was going to be 2/3 in person, 1/3 online. They flipped that ratio almost exactly about a week and a half before class started.
I'll bet they did.
But they already had everybody's commitments to come. So they already had the deposits, but they're like, okay, we'll come anyway and move in. But a lot of you will be online, but that'll be fine. And now, you know, I mean, they haven't officially, I posted, you know, when I figured this out a while ago, I posted like over under was September 14th for them going all online.
I
think that's a pretty good estimate. Yeah. Yeah. And the under might come through, but I think that's about what we're dealing with. So somewhere in that neighborhood.
It's a great scam.
Yeah. No, so
good work if you can get it.
Right. Yeah. And the only problem is that, you know, students or faculty may die. It's the only drawback, you know.
It's all right, though. Because
otherwise, it's fine.
Yeah, they've worked out. It's okay because they worked it out where the faculty actually has now what they call, in some places, they call like a teaching buddy. I don't know if you guys have heard of that, this, where if you teach your class, if the faculty gets sick and dies, your teaching buddy will have been following along so they can pick up, you know, where you left off. And the theory is if you have two old guys, then probably they'll make it through enough of the semester collectively to be able to give at least close to final grades. And then if you've got a young guy, which is obviously optimal, then there's a better than even shot that that young guy is going to, you know, possibly even survive and pass on his knowledge, you know, to somebody else before his family that he's infected dies. So there's, you know, this is we're adaptable, guys, I think is the point here. You know, humans
great
are adaptable.
Great system, you
know, of yeah. death.
Right. We're adaptable as long as we continue to make money. As long as money is made yes. for someone, that is all that matters. I should say that I'm not shilling for my university, but I am happy to note that we do not have to come up with faculty buddies, nor were we told that we were immediately told any tenured faculty were immediately told that you did not have to come in for, you know, did not have to go online in front of class for any reason if you did not want to in the fall, to which I was like, thank you. And then a couple of people were like, well, you know, there's just to keep in mind, you know, we do right now have about a 75% to 80% online to 20% ratio. And I'm like, that's right, because we're trying not to die. And they're like, so, you know, we'll have to think about what the long-term impact of that is. I'm like, the long-term impact is you're going to draw upon your endowment and we're going to be here because I'm not going to kill my kids or myself. Thank you. I built up a fair bit of, I'd like to think, capital over 17 plus years at St. John's, and I'm a tenured full professor. I am now cashing in that capital on not dying. And I think that's a boss fight in Final Fantasy. This is where you use the capital, right?
This is where you have all of those elixirs that you've saved for the entire game that you never used.
I have a lot of Phoenix Downs and I don't want to use them, and I'm going to use my elixirs instead. You got it. So I literally wrote them back and I was like, yeah, thanks. And I attached da 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 da. No, I'm just kidding. I didn't do that. But no, I mean, but other than that, you know, they've been, the thing that I don't understand, this is the thing that comes out of the woodwork every time this happens and it drives me up a wall, and it is the educational technologists. And these are basically like tech bros, like Elon Musk, et cetera, except to me, they're a little more obnoxious because they're not really all that bright, so they basically just hover around waiting for a chance to use more buzzwords. So a few years ago, it was flipped classroom, and that was the bit, you know, like every time they could be like, excuse me, have you heard the good news about flipped classrooms, you know? And so for this one, it's the idea is high flex. Now, I think I may have told you guys about this off air, but I'm not sure if we've talked about, have we talked about hybrid? Have you heard the good news about hybrid flex?
Not from you. I've heard the good news from my own emails.
It sounds very redundant, a redundant term to me.
It is. It very much is. It's a redundant system that, you know, allows you to do more work. So let me tell you the joys of hybrid flex. So first of all, the principle you need to be clear on, Russ, is that it is most important overall that we do what is best for our students. And what is best for our students involves putting them at risk so that this university can get money up front. Okay. Just accept that as the sort of main principle of high flex. I'm joking. That's not what they say, but I'm actually not joking because that's what it really means. So they want people to be able to come onto campus, but they recognize that a lot of people don't want to die. And so how are you going to deal with that? Like, how are you going to address the needs of people who don't want death? And so what they've decided to do is they want to maintain educational outcomes. They want to establish new educational paradigms. They want to do something like flipping classrooms, and mostly they want to make money. In comes HyFlex. So HyFlex has the following characteristics. It is a class in which you have a face-to-face class of a certain number of people, evenly spaced, which makes no difference because you're indoors and the only one who cares about wiping down every seat are the people who care about hygiene theater. What matters is the air, but whatever. You're in this classroom, windows open, and hopefully with, you know, COVID circulating, however it happens to be, right? You got those people in and they're all masked. Then you've got the professor up front in back of a desk in front of which has been established a plexiglass shield, because as we know, plexiglass shields create full immunity against micron-sized. Right, yeah. Exactly. Like micron-sized drifting viruses can't get into or around plexiglass. So it's good for that reason.
Plus also stops bullets just in case.
Yeah. So it doubles as a beneficial item, and also makes it even harder for students to hear you or you to hear the students. So it's really conducive to many.
You mean a mask and a plexiglass shield is hard to communicate
through? Plus a face shield for some of them. I mean, like, you know.
I know. It's full. I've been doing that like when I go to the bank to get quarters for laundry or something like that. Like, I have a mask. She has a mask. There's a giant, like, double pane plexiglass thing between us. Yep. And so it's just like,
I really do sound now like the teacher and Charlie Brown. Like, I've arrived.
I've just taken to screaming at people whenever I need something.
Which really helps cut down on viral load, too. So you've got this setup, right? So that sounds fine. But then you've got people in face-to-face, but we need to be flexible. And we need to create a mix of both flexible sort of, you know, online learning and offline learning. So you have an online class, which is meeting at the same time. And they zoom into the class. So you've got a webcam facing you. You've got on your screen in front, you've got the Zoom kids. And then you've also got the kids that are in the classroom. Now, here's the best part. The best part about this is that you are supposed to be able to, as a student, flow smoothly and with no difficulty in between those systems at will, by which I mean you could come in and take the class on Monday and Thursday, then be at home for the following Monday, Thursday, then dip in for a Monday, Thursday, go back home for a couple of weeks, come back in for a Monday, maybe show up on Thursday, but probably not stay at home, and do this seamlessly with zero impact on your grade, but, and this is really important, with identical educational outcomes for everyone, whether they are online all the time, offline all the time, or combined all the time. Identical educational outcomes as the professor deals with not one group, not two groups, but three groups. The ones who were always in class, the ones who were always not in class, and the ones who are freely like the wind moving between them, the wind carrying COVID, the moving between them on a regular basis. And it has the added benefit of allowing the professor to do three times the work for exactly the same amount of money. So in every respect, the HyFlex is the pinnacle of modern educational technology, which is completely and utterly useless for any pedagogical purpose, but has the benefit of making a lot of money for educational technologists who really want you to have lots of Zoom and video cameras in your classroom.
I look forward to when the emojis are available to be disappointed face at people who haven't had their eyes attached to their screen for a certain amount of time.
Yep.
So we can replicate the disappointed professor.
So to be clear, you like this, right?
This is the best, listen, right? It's a great. I mean, they actually used that. Someone used that word, and I went and I looked it up, and I'm like, I swear to God, I'm not making it up. I stared for literally 2 minutes because I'm like, I can't be seeing this right. This can't be right. Like, there's no way they would want people to. Sure enough. So yeah. Again, no, thank you. I am online completely. I don't want to be. I hate online teaching. This is not my thing that I want to do. It's not what I signed up for. But and I'm online largely, mostly synchronous because I don't want to spend my life looking at message boards and I don't think it's good education. So I'm online synchronous and I'm, you know, and my students, for the most part, my students are doing, you know, have been doing all right. And I have to say, and this is the thing that kills me, and then I'll shut up about my education experience. This just kills me. I love the fact that all of these education technologists, you know who they never speak to about what's best for the students? Is the students. Because if you ask the students, my students are overwhelmingly attending class, knock on wood, in person. Like really, my attendance has been, you know, like if I have 23 kids, I've had like 19 or 20 every time. And the reason I think for that is because I'd like to think I'm good at what I do. And they clearly want contact with each other. And so, you know, no one asked them, there's a few of those people who are actually on campus. So they're actually attending my online class from on campus. So we're really through the looking glass there. I don't know what to make of that. But like, it amazes me because the theory was, well, you got to meet students where they are. I'm like, you don't even know where they are. You have no idea where they are.
You literally don't know where they are.
You lost them back in 1988 in Topeka, dude. You have no idea where the students are.
That's great. Students
don't want to deal with 6 million PowerPoint presentations and a bunch of 7,000 different things they have to have, that have to be due at different days. And they're 18 to 21. They want some freaking structure. That's what most students want. So why don't you ask them? But no, because that doesn't make money for the educational technologists. We need to ask the educational technologists. I mean, it's just absolutely insane. And for people who, and believe me, online education is what is keeping a lot of people alive right now. I am grateful to have a job and to be able to teach in some capacity and not to be able to not have to die of coronavirus, believe me. So I'm not complaining about that. I'm glad the technology exists. And I'm also glad that for people who are dealing with severe disability, for which this is a thing that allows them to attend school when they wouldn't have been able to otherwise, in no way am I disparaging any of that. What I am disparaging is the usual assumption, which is one size fits all, and we need to go and do this for everyone, even under the aegis of, we need to be flexible. We're going to be flexible by force feeding them flexibility. Like, we're going to force them to be, you will be flexible, you know? Like, what the...
That's not how they teach yoga? Are you sure?
Good Christ, man. No, downward facing Dean, right? Like, I just... No, but I mean, so
really. I've read a lot about that. Basically, every college or university that doesn't have a massive endowment to draw upon is now in threat of like collapsing completely.
Because they're in trouble without support. Yeah,
there's a whole class of graduating students who's deferring going to college at all. Right. Obviously, a lot of the parents are questioning whether they should be paying 30 or 40 grand to a university for an online remote experience where people aren't, you know, socializing or doing regular college things, and it seems like somebody who's estimating that like half of the colleges will have disappeared in a few years or something like that. Do you have any commentary on that?
I don't think it will be that many, but I think it will be enormous. I think in the end, you will see probably a third, is my guess, of colleges will have closed. And the sad part is that that's going to largely hit community colleges, because community colleges, which really are serving typical, right? The underprivileged, the ones like that, they're the ones that are going to be hit the most. If you look at places like Harvard, do you know that Harvard has I got to look this up again. I'm pretty sure that I read that Harvard has before I even say the number.
Yeah, I know. Harvard could like build another Harvard inside a bubble.
Yeah, here we go. You ready? Here we go. Last year, their endowment is $40.9 billion. Harvard could literally be closed for 5 years with zero income and could pay every faculty member and staff with zero difficulty. So yeah. Harvard is fine. St. John's honestly has a $750 million endowment because they were able to sell a couple of buildings in Manhattan some years ago. And so they couldn't do this forever.
They can't build another Harvard.
They can't build another Harvard. But they have something which Harvard doesn't have, and that's a little thing we call the Vatican, which has no interest in letting its second largest private Catholic university in the United States and the biggest one in New York close. So they have a little bit of money.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, the reality is like, so everyone is going to have to, you know, is going to have to tighten their belts, whatever. We're in the middle of a contract negotiation, so there will be no raises for us on this contract.
Yeah, it's like, who has leverage in this situation?
Yeah, but I mean, but having right. said that, you know, the one thing this has done, and I think this is actually, to get back to your point, Russ, I think the thing that this is, I'm curious about what Story thinks, but I think what this really has done, and it shouldn't have taken this for it to happen, but it did, is what this has done is show full-timers and tenure-track people and even tenured people how vulnerable their jobs and universities are, just the way the adjuncts have been for the last 15 years. And as the adjunctification of the academy has continued and the split has continued so that now only about 30% of the faculty is actually tenured or tenure track, because you'd much rather, you know, pay adjuncts nothing and give them no benefits and have them no governance. That's a lot cheaper for them. this has brought together those groups in ways that I would not have thought possible before. So you actually see full-timers and part-timers now clearly connected. There are unionization movements in tons of schools, and all of this, I think, is to the good. I think that's very positive. So I think you will lose about a third of colleges and universities, but I also think you'll have a much more unified workforce, which is going to be much better for everybody, including students, including parents. It means that, you know, you're going to have to get rid of, you know, 50% of the bloated administrative staff at most of these schools who should never have been there in the first place. But yeah, and it's bad news for the educational technologists probably. But yeah, so I do think it's going to be a big, like, seismic shift in the landscape. But I also think we're going to come out of it with a much more clear-eyed vision of what, you know, what people really actually value. It really opened a lot of eyes when they were getting things like, you know, why aren't you going in and teaching students behind a plexiglass shield with a bunch of masks in a room that was last HVAC compliant, you know, in 1900, you know, like, why don't you want to do that? So that really opened some eyes. So I'm optimistic about that. It's just, in the meantime, there's a lot of people who are getting hurt. We had a voluntary buyout thing at our university, which they've done a couple of times. And like a couple of people in my own department took it. So my department shrunk. You know, just because they were older and they were at risk, and they were like, I might as well take the VSO while I have it. So yeah, you know, across the country in particular, it's going to be a big seismic shift. And if it means that NYU isn't spending $70,000 per year, which is what it currently costs, by the way, to go to NYU, that'll be a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think obviously, you know, as we've all said, this will affect the economy of major universities.
But I feel so bad for the community colleges, though. I really do. Like, and the students they serve. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to really hurt them a lot. So
coming out of this, a lot of commentators have also said that perhaps we have over-collegeed the, you know, graduating high school classes in general, and that a college degree maybe isn't necessary for everyone, especially given the student load that you know,
right,
everyone of a certain age is carrying around, given the people with, like, even advanced master's degrees and things who can't find reasonable jobs, who are working, like, Postmates and whatever.
Right.
Now, you know, obviously, like, we all know, I would assume that we all think that education is valuable. We all had a wonderful time in college, and you guys in grad school, and you know, even as a liberal arts major, like, I think that all of those studies were valuable, even though none of them were vocational at all.
Right.
But I think that it is a compelling argument to say, like, is, for, you know, every single person, is college really necessary as opposed to some kind of vocational training? And I think, you know, probably not.
I agree. I mean, I actually think now that probably I used to think that actually it is important for everybody, because the experience beyond anything else is so mind broadening for so many people who don't get it any other way. This is why, you know, there's always an attack on universities and colleges, because they don't want, as we've seen, they don't want people to learn. And when you get their people's minds broadened and they're like, wait, why are the politicians lying to us? That's not good for business if you're a politician. So I used to think that, but I actually now believe that you're right. I think what you were talking about is right. I think that you don't need everyone to go to college, but I would like to see, and I'm curious what you guys think, I would like to see vocational training that is married with some kind of, you know, mind broadening experience that isn't just instrumental. Because I think one of the problems with saying vocational tech is that's a nice way of saying, we need you to go do stuff so you can go make money for business again. And I would like to see something that literally can change people's minds about things, like having something that allows people, almost like, it reminds me a little bit of like the Life board game. Like, you come to a spot in life and you can go this way or that way, like, if only you could make career choices this easily, right? But you can go left, right, you can go to school or whatever. It would be great if that option were available so that people even knew what options were available to them. And then, yes, I think they should be able, some people should be able to do vocational stuff for sure, as long as voc tech is not just, I send you to a place where you can do metal shop for a year or two, and then you get to go out and become a Trump voter because you've never actually taken a class past, you know, 17, you know?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it would be nice if people could, you know, actually make use out of the huge repository that's the internet, which is like the collective, you know, human knowledge presented. Obviously, it needs to be filtered and funneled in certain ways so people know how to use it.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, as someone who did not go to school for anything vocational. Like, arguably the only skill that I developed, or rather the most important skill that I developed in college, was just the ability to think and just how to assess, arguments, how to assess, how to digest media. Like, all of that was incredibly important, but in terms of like how to research, that's basically what I do now in terms of my consulting work. It's all about finding critical information and researching. But at no point was there ever, in my experience, because I specifically avoided going to law school, I specifically avoided doing STEM because I didn't feel like it.
Right.
But yeah, that was my, and it was a positive experience, but also I could certainly understand how somebody with a high degree of academic achievement could then go into the real world and go, well, now there's nothing for me to do that will compensate me fairly. I get that.
Yeah. I guess I worry that what might happen is that we'll say, yes, go do voc tech and stuff like that, and we'll make that a more viable thing and we'll push that. And what that ends up meaning is that we basically move people away from exactly what you just said, which is learning how to think. I don't believe that you should have to go to college to be better able to think and to be better able to socially understand others who don't come from your small little hometown or whatever. But I think unless we make it as part of this vocational tech experience, that something else becomes a, if not universally done, at least a very broadly accepted, method of doing something where you can get that kind of thing as well. Because what I don't want is just to make this into more of a, how do we prep them for factories? Because there's already too much of the prepping for factories thing as it is. And I would like to see less of that, and I wouldn't want the voc tech thing to contribute to that. But beyond that, I'm with you. I certainly think there are people that would not, would benefit from just not having to go to college and incur that kind of debt. I just worry about the implications of it, I guess. What do you think, Story?
I mean, my solution to this is kind of, may seem like it's out of left field, but
no,
I think,
we never do that.
No, I think that my answer to this is that I think we should have compulsory 1 year national service. And I've been a big fan of this idea for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And I think you should not be allowed to attend college or have a full-time job until you do this. So it doesn't have to be right at 19, but you basically, this is a prerequisite to get into anything nationwide. And you are given a wide array of, obviously I would prohibit it from being military service. That's not the idea. It's not go kill other people in other countries. But that it can be basically anything. It can be any kind of, and that there would be a lot of things set up like a works program where you can, maybe you spend your year, a lot of it's what would traditionally be volunteer work or community service work, but it's organized, it's paid, it's actually compensated. And, maybe some of the things would be competitive. I don't think so. I think, you rank 10 things that you want and it's kind of random draw for whether you get your first choice. It can be all over the country, so you can move if you want to. You can do it in your community if you want to. And I think that that would broaden everyone's horizons. I think a lot of people who go to college on autopilot would realize hey, I like working with my hands, or I like doing this kind of thing, or I'm really driven into this service oriented thing, or I never knew I had this skill in this, or I definitely know I don't want to do this after doing it for a year.
Yeah.
I think AmeriCorps, tries to do this, but it's not compulsory. It pays people. It literally works by giving people food stamps. It doesn't pay a living anything. It's like this weird mix of all of these things that are service programs in America are both treat people really poorly, but also are really competitive to get into, which is a really bizarre mix of things. And so they never end up so you don't have an intermingling of people of different socioeconomic classes,
right,
or even different, intelligence levels or anything. You don't broaden anyone's horizon. You narrow people's horizons. You increase a savior complex for the 1% and their children. And it just has a lot of negative effects. So a compulsory service program, everybody has to do it. It becomes a unifying thing. It becomes a rite of passage. Even if people all unify by hating it and resenting it, they bond with each other over that, and that's fine. But I think it would really cross-pollinate where people can leverage this who might not have been college bound can leverage this to an opportunity to go to college. People who are on autopilot to college may decide they don't want it. And you just have more of that flexibility and social mobility. And like 19 is the kind of time that you should be doing stuff like right. that. Like you don't necessarily know where you're going.
He always thought you should take a year in between.
Yeah.
He always thought.
Yeah. And but now in a highly competitive environment, doing it comes at a great cost, right? You're sacrificing something because, but this would level the playing field where everybody's doing it. So you would have something that's unifying. And I think that would be, you know, and people talk about, I mean, especially in this era in 2020 of like, oh, we're so disunited and people don't see the humanity in each other and whatever, like what a way to bring that back where you have to work with all classes and all races to support your community or another community within the nation and get a different perspective.
I think that's a terrific idea. At first, it reminded me a little bit of the Purgs, and I got a little wary because I was like,
"No, that's the whole issue. That's the whole problem. Is the Purgs and AmeriCorps and TFA to an extent, right? Like they abuse people.
That was when exactly. I was gonna say. I remembered it when you said they treat people poorly. I'm like, oh, the Purgs.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
What about the Peace Corps, by the way? I understand that's not in America. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it is by America.
Oh, I mean, I think the Peace Corps. So I think the Peace Corps could be great. I think the Peace Corps is largely a tool of American imperialism right now, but I don't think it has to be, and I think it could be retooled. I would personally, though, I think just because of the universality, I think is really important to this. I would say Peace Corps can be something you go into the following year after this, but I don't think you can use... For my money at this point, I think I could be persuadable on this, but I think that I would rather see everybody do this domestically, and then you can go to the Peace Corps after that if you want.
I see. Okay.
Just because I think I worry in part that it would then create a tiering system. I think there's just so many ways, like America is so obsessed with competition that they would find a way to make it a tiered system where it's like, oh, but the really cool people go international and then it's all the like whatever. And it's just,
where'd you go for your Peace Corps experience? I went to Canada.
Right.
And I did some good work for the Quebecois.
Yeah. I just think it's really,
I helped them secede from the rest of Canada. It was a wonderful year.
I understand now their distaste for people around them.
Uh-huh. I look forward to bringing this tool set back to the United States.
I have learned to apologize and drink much syrup.
Yeah, you get it.
Yeah, no, so, listen, I'm with Russ. I think this is a good idea. Especially because it's not, it reminds me a little bit of the Israeli system, except it's not serving in the military.
Right, but it's not. Yeah, problems. Exactly. Right. And so. Yeah, and a lot of countries do this, but with the military, but it's like propagandistic, it's indoctrination, exactly. It's dehumanizing the people that you're trying to kill and promoting the people that you are. And,
exactly.
You know, there's just, it is in ethos the opposite of what I'm going for here.
No, I agree. No, I think it's I think it's a great idea.
It hits me what you said about people feeling like they have no investment in, you know, American communities. Mm-hmm. And that's like part of the malaise / anger that a lot of young people are feeling.
Yeah.
Combined with, you know, being in debt, not having access to housing, not feeling like they have a stake in the country. And so being much more likely to say, well, I will burn it down then because it has nothing for me. So let's just break everything.
It is interesting to, I agree with you, Russ. And it's interesting to see how the Overton window has been shifting to the left on a lot of these discussions. I have to say, one of the things that was interesting, I don't really necessarily want to get into this specific topic of this, just because I don't think it's really that interesting that much, except for this one point, which is that I heard a lot of people after the RNC was over, we're talking about, you know, a lot of people on my Twitter feed and, you know, lefties and Democrats and those, you know, everybody in that sort of general left of center crew were just feeling down about stuff. And there were some people who were kind of like, you know, but why? Like, it's not a polling thing. Like, you know, Trump, basically they've shown, didn't really get much of a bounce from it, whatever. And people were like, and what the point that a lot of people were making was, the point is not whether we're going to win or lose the election. The point was simply, it's just depressing to see the extent to which some people will lie. Like the extent to which this kind of just downbeat, blatant lie over and over again, just, you know, blissfully with no problem. It's just sort of, you just feel bad after you went to it. And I think so much of it has become this sort of instrumental thing where it's like, if you feel down, therefore you believe X, Y, Z will occur. And it's not, no, that just sucked. You know, it's like, I consider myself a reasonably optimistic person, but 2020 has sucked. I mean, it's been an awful year. It's just been a terrible year. We've lost 180,000 plus people in America alone from COVID, and that's clearly an undercount. It's, you know, we've lost hundreds of thousands across the world. We've lost, you know, we were talking about various celebrities and people like that that actually made a difference in people's lives, not just random celebrities. The effect that it's had on groups of people that we work with, you know, our own family. I mean, it just sucks. And I think it's okay to say, you know what, 2020 has been to die in a fire. It's garbage. Everything about it sucks. The Black Lives Matter situation with the horrific continual shooting of people of color by violent police. It just has sucked. And I think you can acknowledge that without being like, it sucks. And you're like, are you saying that it will all never get better? And you're like, well, no, I mean, we have to work to get better. But can we first just, Clea says this all the time, former guest star on the Met Report, my wife, says all the time that the problem that people have with expressing emotion is that they don't allow themselves to feel the wave of it. So it's like, you're allowed to feel that was shitty. And then you come out on the other side and you're like, okay, so let's buckle up now and let's think about what's next. It's like, if you acknowledge that you're low, then that makes some statement about you, right? Or if you acknowledge that you're doing great, that also makes some statement about you. And you're like, I'm just riding the wave, man. And right now there's been a lot of low waves, and it's okay to express and feel that thing that you're feeling this way. And so I don't know.
Part of the problem is that you have these social media tools that everyone is on all the time.
Yeah.
That doom give scrolling, you rewards. Right? Yeah. Well, yeah. Like present you with an assortment of all of the worst things going on in the world at any given time, which humans were never built to process right. All of the bad things at once. No. But then also has this perverse reward mechanism where if you, you know, if you're angry, if you're horrified, if you're revolted, those feelings get magnified by the tool. And yes. So those are the things yes. That get passed around the most. And like I said, you know, the fact that I wrote a media literacy case randomly for debate when I was, you know, 15 was like the most valuable random thing that I ever did, so that yep. I understood a bit about how to digest various things that are being, and that was in, you know, 1995. And can you imagine 25 years later, like how magnified everything is, how many ads everyone's absorbing on a daily basis, how much people are being manipulated psychologically by various forces from the media to foreign countries, et cetera. Like without being equipped to deal with that, it destroys people mentally.
You know, I wondered what do we do to sort of put this on a line with, I think we all agree that sort of the citizen journalism thing has the potential to be very powerful as a kind of decentered fact gathering thing, assuming we can figure out how to filter all of that. But you know, that there's great value in almost like crowdsourcing, you know, information gathering. But how do we connect that with what you just said, Russ? Because you're right, like media literacy is enormously important. And in a way, because social media amplifies the worst of it or the worst feelings that you're having, it creates the scenario. Because obviously a lot of people are like, well, I'm just going to get off it altogether. I'm like, well, the problem there is that if you just shut yourself off from every occurrence in the world, so you're like, okay, I'm going to be in my own bubble. I mean, that may be better for your mental health, but it means that there is real damage being done to people around you that you don't know about because you're not plugged in. But absorbing the fire hose of negative news that gets amplified by, you know, social media seems bad also. So like, how do we need to have like maybe mandatory focus on not just ethics, but a mandatory focus on things like media literacy and how to
filter? I think for sure we should have some kind of federal regulation on entities like Facebook and Twitter. Like they cannot be allowed to make all these decisions internally about what gets through, what gets banned, what gets censored, what doesn't, who gets manipulated by whom. Like this is, at this point, it's beyond the breadth of a public utility in terms of how many people it affects and how necessary it is to everyday life. So they just can't be allowed to wield that much power. Sorry. I don't care that Facebook leans one way politically and Twitter leans the other way politically. Like it doesn't matter.
I agree with you totally.
Too much effect. I do want to bring up one great book that I read last year by Neal Stephenson, one of my favorite sci-fi authors, sure. Called Fall, subtitle, or Dodge in Hell. So the book, it's like two different stories. One story is about an afterlife that's created in a digital sphere to upload consciousnesses and just kind of watching what they do when you have this basically Minecraft world inhabited by souls, like, and how they decide to build their own society. So that's fascinating. Back while this is all developing over the course of decades, in the real world, the United States has been totally broken into two entities. There's like the regular US, and then there's like Ameristan, where, you know, people like take biblical, old biblical rules seriously, so, and they don't believe in science. Yeah. Yeah. It's a parody of,
just want to make sure.
It's a parody of that. and like, all of the rich people in this world have professional curators who curate their media streams for them so that they get the right kind of good information. And these are like high level jobs where you'll curate some rich person's Twitter or Facebook or whatever stream so that they're not bombarded by ads. And this is only something that rich people can afford, is this level of of this filter that helps them to digest all of the crap that is being spewed in every direction. And I think it's a fascinating look at a very possible future.
It is interesting, isn't it, that because so much is driven by the money and so much is driven by profit, even in this kind of world, which seems not that far off from what we're dealing with, that it means that even the process of being able to think, of having space, of having time, even that is driven by finance. And by, you know, and again, we talked about this, I think, in our last episode or maybe a couple of them ago, where this is one thing that has been, I think, the biggest reset. I think the biggest reason that the Overton window has shifted is because people have time to think about it. I think that's why. I think people have been home and were like, oh, crap, this is what's happening, because they're not having to work 14-hour days, you know, to try to survive on a daily basis, or in some cases are not able to do so. And so it's almost they've been put into a forced pause, and they're like, oh God, what is going on with the world? You know? And that I just know for myself that I can easily get overwhelmed if I'm in certain environments where it's hot and there's too many people. And like, I don't do well with that, which makes me not understand exactly why I love, you know, Gen Con game conventions, but it doesn't fit. I don't know what I think that is, though. I think that's because everyone's Gen Con is different, though. I mean, like, my Gen Con is driven by the Writers Symposium, which has definitely a few thousand attendees, but they're not all in the place at the same time. You know, we're talking to rooms of, you know, a couple hundred, right? And so that's not quite the same thing as being crammed into a space like... Yeah. In the main exhibit hall, that's a little different, but even there, you're going to a place and then you're immediately compartmentalizing yourself into the bubble of the game that you play, I think is the way I would describe it. So it's a little bit of a different experience, but I know how I am and like how I just need time. Like right now I can talk to you guys in my relatively quiet office in, you know, my currently relatively quiet home in a relatively quiet area of New York City. They do exist. And because we figured out a way to finally break down coronavirus, we actually don't have ambulances wailing past the window every 3 seconds now. And there is some opportunity for peace here. And that's privilege, right? I'm only able to do that because my parents worked their asses off and because my father was killed in an accident, which led to a settlement because he was wrongfully killed because the person, you know, was irresponsible and drove into him. And after being awake for 30 hours driving in a trucking company, I mean, you know, so there was a settlement and my mother was smart about it and saved her money. And I was able to sell her house. And because of all of these things that had nothing to do with me, I have the privilege of being able to talk with you guys in relative peace and quiet. And it is wrong that is a privileged position, you know, beyond everything else, beyond anything.
I don't know if it's like, wrong. It's just kind of random chance. It's lucky, you know,
but it's privileged.
Sure. Yeah. But I mean, you can't, I don't well, think I'm, that I'm there's any that system I'm you could devise that would eliminate chance. I'm not saying fault either. I'm just saying some things are random and some, like, no matter how, I don't think that you can design society to such a heavy-handed degree that luck will not influence that some people have a better quality of life than other people.
It's a question of degree, though, right? Like, I think the goal of societal engineering should be to minimize the amount to which luck affects your outcomes, right? Like, that is
minimize the lottery.
Tantamount, goal, right? Like, yeah, you can acknowledge that luck exists, right? Like I believe in an ordered universe and a higher power. Like, disease and natural disaster are there to remind us that we're never going to overcome it completely, and there's always things to fight against. But, like, the first order we can do is stop making things worse for each other as humans.
Amen.
Like, not magnify the luck that we're born into based on that.
So, of course, I agree with that, and I agree with, you know, the veil of Kant's veil of ignorance and all that stuff. On a personal level, I just want to reinforce that, like, Greg, you should not for a moment feel ashamed that you are in a position of privilege, because you've paid for that privilege in a very real way. And I don't at all buy into this argument that, like, you know, if my great-great-grandfather did some horrible act, that, like, I should be personally ashamed if I've tried to live my life as a good person. Like, you can acknowledge it. You can say maybe we need policies to rebalance the scales in some form and, like, advocate for progressive policies. But to carry around personal guilt over something that you had nothing to do with is, Russ, I do not buy that for a second.
Listen, Russ, guilt is my personal birthright, and I'll thank you to stay away from my personal birthright from my family of guilt, okay? I was given that by my parents, and I actually really appreciate that. That's very kind of you to say. I mean, I know you're making a point beyond that, but I appreciate that. Yeah, I think what I would put, though, I think I would take that in a slightly different direction. I agree with you completely that one is not responsible for the sins of one's fathers and grandfathers, but one is responsible for pretending that those sins did not exist. And that is what I think too much of our society does. It doesn't acknowledge that some people are in different positions, not because we all started at the same start line and then we ended up somewhere different by the finish line, but because many of us started a mile away from the start line and never got to the same point anybody else did, having nothing to do with us. And that doesn't mean that what we did, therefore, is bad. It just means to put that into some perspective. So, you know, this is why I am increasingly attempting to, you know, it's a privileged position to be able to, for example, run a Twitch channel, which I've run now for 8+ years, and to be able to do that with a bunch of tabletop games, which are the most important sort of the most important recreation of my life, bar hanging out with you guys and hanging out with friends and people like that, is being able to run a channel with, like, the tabletop stuff. And, you know, leaving aside family, that's a whole separate category, but, like, on this level is doing the tabletop stuff and playing games.
You said tabletop was higher. No, nope,
more important. Yeah, let me just add some guilt. Thanks, Mom. So
we'll never be railroad tycoons.
But, like, it is a privilege to be able to have that. But the difference is, instead of just sort of throwing up my hands and pretending, you know, being like, well, nope, I'm just going to go and be apolitical, whatever the fuck that means. And I'm just going to be here on my channel. I'm going to do what I do. Instead, I have gone out of my way now to try to see that representation is increased and to put stuff back into Black Lives Matter. And we ran, you know, I was able to run this con. I think I told you guys about this July con, we called it, which was a virtual con held on my channel to benefit the Octavia E. Butler Memorial Scholarship, which pays for talented writers of color to be able to attend Clarion, which is a major fantasy writing convention that is a big springboard for people getting into careers and creative work. And it, again, is for writers of color. And we raised $1,300 for that in a day. And we had Rick Riordan, who does the Percy Jackson series, you know, playing D&D with us to make that happen. Like, that is the kind of thing which I have been able to do. And I'm proud of the fact that I didn't just close my eyes to it and go, no, I think it's a lot easier if I just play a bunch of games and, you know, continue to do what I do and pretend that politics don't exist. Like, I took in context what it was, the privilege that I had, and I tried to do something with it. And I'm trying to continually do that on a regular basis. So I think it's more the sort of understanding, I don't know, it's like the with great power comes great responsibility. Like, I don't have great power, but I have some. And I think I have some, you know, God-given talent and some talent that I've worked very hard to hone. And I've tried to use that from all of my life for good. And I've tried to do more of that for good. And I'm proud of what I've done so far. And I want to do much more, of course. But it's a matter of understanding first what's there. And I think people just get so defensive when you bring it up to begin with that they're just kind of, well, no, I did this and I worked hard and I was poor. And the point is not to hammer people for coming from wherever they were. Like you say, Russ, like, that's nobody's fault. But then you can't, once you have it, just pretend like it doesn't exist and do the social Darwinist bullshit of looking back at people who didn't make it and going, well, there must be a reason they didn't, as if you weren't in that position, if you follow what I mean. So that's all. I really appreciate what you said, though. That means a lot to me. But I guess I would say I want to also have us look at the context of our lives and try to take that into account with what we do, I guess.
I think that it's obviously very noble, and something that we all share is that we're trying to improve the quality of the world and we're trying to bring more good to people who are without it. And I think that that's, you know, it's hard to argue with any of that. I don't think, because I feel like part of the overwhelming dominance of cultural behavior right now says that certain people have to be guilty because certain people are complicit in crimes and things like that. I think all that comes from the wrong place. Like, I get it. Like, crimes are committed. Like, our country is founded on murders. Like, pretty much
right.
All of human civilization is a murder wheel that has, like, very recently slowed down a bit. Like, that's pretty much what human civilization is.
Although, I'm telling you, man, you got to read Rutger Bregman's Humankind book, because it will open your eyes to a lot of course. That.
Yeah, anyway. I mean, infinite kindnesses and infinite savagery, and that's just kind of like, when you start, I think it's, like, you can kind of do it in the contained system of this is our nation and this is the history, specific history of our nation. But you can also just kind of, like, if we sit and try to make tally marks about whose ancestors did what to whom, I don't think it's the most productive exercise in the world. To be like, am I going to, like, you know, be mean to German people for the rest of my life because of things that happen, like, you know, because of things that their great-grandparents did to my great-grandparents? Like, I just don't. No, I don't find any benefit in that.
Certainly, but don't you think, I completely agree with that, but I mean, don't you think it's reasonable, though, for, you know, for example, for people to acknowledge that there is a reason why we want to give, for example, just in my specific small case, scholarships to people or to writers of color, because there is an overwhelming bias even now towards largely white and largely heterosexual and largely male, you know, writers and audiences. Like, I shouldn't say audiences, but writers. I mean, isn't it reasonable to say, it's not sort of asking you, like, hey, you, why don't you make up for the sins of your grandfathers? But it is to say that then, I'm not saying you're doing this, but I'm just using the royal you, then you should not be wandering around complaining about the fact that such scholarships exist. You know what I mean? That like, you shouldn't be complaining about the idea that other people get some benefits.
I think it's a very small minority of people who have a problem with, like, the NAACP setting up scholarships for, you know, mm-hmm. people of color. Like, I think it's a very, very tiny portion of the population. I think there's a larger portion of the population that has a problem with, like, so, like, one of the big issues is the, what was it, Harvard or Yale, one of those two were sued for discriminating against Asian kids because Harvard or Yale made the argument that we want a certain representative diverse class.
Right.
And to do that, we have to discriminate against some of the top qualified students who are disproportionately Asian. So again, this has nothing to do.
Hasn't that case been thrown out, though, or are they just going to be? I don't know.
Yeah, they lost.
They lost, okay.
The Asians who sued lost.
Okay.
But it's like, I think it's an interesting case because it takes completely out of the equation the whole, like, we live in a white supremacist nation, et cetera, because this is not about white people. This right. is about a whole bunch of different nationalities grouped under Asian that for whatever reason, they come from cultures where they, like, have an incredible work ethic, or they, you know, all made Harvard, like, the highest value in their lives and they worked super hard, and they were discriminated against because of a feeling that the representation had to be different than simply who scored highest on the tests. And, you know, it's like, I get the conflicting philosophies at play, but I don't think that it's completely wrong to, if you're an Asian person, to be like, well, because my group is overrepresented, then I get screwed.
Although isn't the battle, that's fair, although it feels to me a little bit like, shouldn't the battle be against the overwhelming number of sort of Caucasian, you know, like through legacy.
Well, it should be against, like,
so
the
on.
Legacies. Yeah, the people
right, like,
who just
like,
get in
that
without
the
qualifications
not,
at all.
Right, like, because again, it's like fighting the 10% of the pie next to you on the chart as opposed to fighting the 80%, right? Like, and that's I think, again, that's what they want you to do. They want you to fight each other and not them. So.
Oh, sure. And, like, but, nobody has a better chance of getting in than someone whose parent donated a library
there
to
you
a
go.
University.
Yeah,
like,
there
no
you
doubt.
The legacy is the death system. But I agree with you in general terms. Yeah, I think it's interesting. Yeah. What do you think about this story? Where do we, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I.
Listen, New Mexicans get all the benefit. All right. So, like,
I mean, the New Mexicans do have an edge, you know. They, state diversity is something that a lot of people care about. I mean, my boss, she has a very bright son, and like, they used to live in DC, you know, and she's very, you know, or in Arlington, you know. And they're very glad they moved to West Virginia because he's going to have the inside track, right? Like,
yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, right. So that's, you know, that's a thing. I don't know. I think I question the extent to which like anybody has a right to like a spot in a competitive college, because there's so much luck involved, right? Like, and so much of the luck is accident of birth and things that people didn't have a choice about. Like, I just don't, you know, I strongly question this idea of, oh, like, you have an absolute, you know, you have an absolute right to this or that, or like, you know, there's an objective metric by which you would get in. Like, these things are not, these things are holistic, right? They're not, there's not an objective metric by which some people get in or some people don't. So,
well, we definitely need to be holistic. We need to be way more holistic educationally first. I think right. We can all agree with that.
But like, they can say that
we need to have debate. Okay. We just need universal debate education.
Right.
Let's just be clear. Debate. And I'm only half joking.
If there's one thing the Met Report will say to you.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, right. Like, I'm only half joking. I mean, like, because honestly, that there is so much that goes into the construction of good parliamentary work, debate work, that it really does touch on a lot of things. But sorry, story. I was just
oh, yeah, yeah. No, joke. No, that's fine. Yeah. So I don't know. I think, like, so if diversity is part of what somebody cares about, like, you know, as a community, that's a good value to have. I don't think that you have an absolute, you know, right that, or you can say, oh, I'm getting screwed because like they want to have not everybody be the same race. And, you know, I don't know. I just don't find that argument compelling.
So like, even, and obviously like standardized testing has been criticized for many reasons, and like your income level will to some degree affect your performance on standardized testing,
right,
and all of that stuff. But like, in terms of in a vacuum, like trying to create an objective measurement by which you say like, you know, certain academic achievers are going to do well on this test, like it's pretty good. It's pretty good.
I mean, sure. But what I'm saying is like, it's begging the question about luck, right? Like the point, the idea of the ideal of meritocracy is to make it fair. Cooked into that idea is the presumption that the playing field is level. So at the point where the playing field isn't level and it's all random chance and there's, you know, there's all these genetic factors and accident of birth and, you know, who your parents are and whether you get raised the right way, you know, there's a billion other things involved in this, then the field is not level. And so then a meritocracy isn't what you assume it to be, right?
Okay. So look, it's very easy to deconstruct the like admissions criteria for universities over the last 30 years. Like you can pick it apart and call it inconsistent. Like how do you build one that makes sense other than, do you just say we want our college to have a representative like demographic of our town and that's it? And whoever shows up first in line gets in regardless of their capacity to like absorb the material?
I mean, I think that you could do it a lot of ways, right? You could have a lottery. I mean, I think that that's fine, right? Like, I don't necessarily, again, you know, and I went to a very elite high school, you know, and so I have some experience with this, right? And I got advantages from that. Now I was a scholarship kid and my parents couldn't have afforded it. And, you know, that is what it is. And that was made possible by very wealthy people and whatever. So I guess I'm biting the hand that fed me. But I don't think that, assuming these things are finite, and again, like the primary priority should probably be making sure that these things are not finite, right? Like again, there's some question begging, because cooked into all of this is the assumption that like there's only one Harvard and there's only one, like, and that like 80% of people who go to school are going to get a garbage education, right? Like, that's just a reality of America. That doesn't have to be the reality of America.
Absolutely.
Right? Like that's just our priorities, because we care about not having a garbage military, and we instead want to have, you know, a garbage education system. I don't, like we can make a different set of priorities. Right. And what I would recommend is going to make the set of priorities. Now, if I have to play in a sandbox that says there's only one Harvard and 80% of education is garbage, then yeah, I'm probably leaning toward a lottery, or a lottery of people who can get over a very minimal bar, you know, to have access to that, because that's more reasonable, because it acknowledges that there's no fairness or levelness in the playing field to begin with.
And so there can't be a, you know, a magnet school or an elite institution under that theory, right?
I mean, I think, again, the best use of resources is to make that as available as possible for everyone, right? Like I don't think that the system is not benefited by saying, like, let's tear down all the good education, but there can be a way to distribute it more equitably, and the equitable distribution is more important than the creation of it.
Also, I agree with that totally. And also, part of it is changing the perception of the education that exists already. And I'm thinking about this for a moment, just on the post-secondary level, on the higher education level. You know, the reality is that if you get through, like, so you have, you know, the Yales, the Harvards, the Princetons, the Columbias, you have the top five or six, you know, or seven, UC Berkeley, Stanford, you have somewhere in there, right? And then for specialized things, MIT. So you've got those schools that are within America, and then you've got Oxford and some other places overseas as well, of course. But you have that group. But the reality is that in general, if you don't go to a place that is clearly garbage, a for-profit institution like the University of Phoenix, for example, or one of these places that is just basically a you know, a diploma mill that just wants you to get out there and get your degree and get the hell out, that a lot of these places do give you in general, very solid education from which you can build. But if we continue to look at it as people coming out of those schools are somehow less competent or able because they didn't get into the Harvards or Yales or Columbias for whatever the reason is, we're going to run into that situation. So to use my personal situation as an example, I kind of, you know, effed around in high school. I had not figured out yet what I was. I was bored out of my mind in some of these classes, and I just didn't. And I was also horrifically bullied, which, you know, story can certainly identify with, I know. Sure. And so it was a little bit hard when you're getting hit on the head by 2x4s to concentrate on classes. So I ended up with like a, you know, a B- average, and I B- average, and I did very well on my SATs, but whatever. So I had a couple of options available to me: University of Hartford, University of Connecticut, both for music. Didn't get into either for music. And so, but I did get in academically to both. And so I ended up going to the University of Connecticut. And my father used to be like, you know, well, like, that's not going to have a long-term effect. And I was like, of course it is, Dad, because people are going to come out of the Harvards and the Yales, and they're going to be looking for jobs at the same time that I, coming out of the University of Connecticut, are going to be looking for jobs. What I didn't sort of account for is that in the process of going through that school, I treated like an adult for the first time in my educational life, you know, thrived under that and did exceptionally well, and then got into graduate school at Brandeis, which was a top 30 program, and did exceptionally well there. And I ended up now with a, you know, full professor tenure track position at a university, at a solid university. That's a success story by any standard, right? I mean, like, by any standard, I got a lot done, you know, given the circumstances that I went through, starting from the University of Connecticut. If my parents had been like, no, you just can't go there. No, you would need to wait another year. You know, we'll get you set up for more testing. We'll send you to a prep school, you know, things that sometimes people do, even if they can't really afford it, they just bankrupt themselves so they can do this for their kids. And it sent me so that I was going to go to, you know, NYU as an undergraduate, or not good enough, you know, I don't know, some like, some top level kind of Tufts, you know, whatever, some top level, or Brandeis as an undergraduate, something that would get me above that level. You know, if they had done that, who knows what would have happened to me going from that point forward. University of Connecticut was affordable for me. it was big enough that I had different options in terms of what major I wanted to pursue. And it gave me enough professors that I could connect with that I found something that really spoke to me. And eventually, and it was literally my last year, you guys know the story, that I'm my senior year that I discovered debate. And I was like, holy crap, like mind blown, like this is what it's about. And my entire, having done very well grade-wise, but my career shifted into wanting to work with and teach people in college, young people in college from that point forward. And all of that started with a state school education. And so one of the things we need to do is recalibrate what we think of as successful to begin with. Like my daughter, Senevine, is, you know, we're not going to make a major effort to get her into an Ivy League because it's not that important. It's important that she know who she is, that she finds what she loves, that she connects with what she wants to do, because the money will follow from that, because we're not hung up on keeping up with a million other people in Riverdale that want to send their kid down the street to Riverdale Country Day, where they pay $70,000 a year for a high school so their kid can learn Mandarin. I mean, are you effing kidding me?
I learned Mandarin at a public high school because our social studies teacher happened to have spent a few years in Taiwan and set up a Mandarin.
Happy to. Class. Okay, so happened to have. But you know what
it
I'm saying?
It was pretty like, random. Yeah.
We need to reconfigure what we see as value and what we see as legitimate to begin with. And, you know, like, and so that a state school isn't seen as a death sentence, or a community college is not seen as a death sentence as it is academically for so many people. So that's part of it. We need to look at it differently, I think.
I agree with that. My nit to pick is for a very tiny minority. It doesn't resonate with almost everybody. Okay. Which is that, like, you know, as a gifted kid going through public school in Brooklyn, I was very, very lucky that my PS115 in Canarsie, a very lower middle class neighborhood in Brooklyn, like happened to have a gifted program called the Astor Program, which presumably was funded by John Jacob Astor, who I'm sure is some awful robber baron or something who murdered a bunch of people.
He was a fur trapper in Astoria, Oregon, and where I spent ages 8 to 13 was
nice.
All named after him. Yeah.
I'm sure you were making that up off the top of your head, no. And I was super impressed. I'm like,
no, wow. It's literally true.
I'm sure his despoiling of the pristine environment led to lots of scholarship opportunities for children. Hundreds.
It's okay, Russ. Your success is on the back of a million beavers, okay? A million beaver pelts.
Yeah. So, and I'm sure many natives destroyed or whatever. But anyway, like, it was only via that this program existed that I was able to have a halfway decent public school education, because I was the kind of kid that would, like, be done with whatever the regular classwork was and just be kind of twiddling my thumbs. And it takes extra resources for teachers to go, well, here's some advanced work that you can do so you're not just sitting there bored, you know, with the regular curriculum. And like, that has to exist in some form. And if everything is just a lottery and like, it's good, it's definitely good in terms of creating a society where people can be empathetic and like have experienced lots of other people, the kind of experience you get living in a city. That's very good. But if another one of your goals is that you want to cultivate, you know, the high level talent that you have in your country, which you probably do if you want like high level astronauts and architects and teachers and all these things, that like at some point it does help to have a filtering mechanism for, you know, the talented kids and give them a curriculum that challenges them.
Well, let me counterpoint that, Russ, because the interesting thing about that is I think you can tie that together with what Story was suggesting. The key to this, because I also was saved by a gifted and talented program in my high school, but it sure wasn't because I was bored and getting done with things too quickly, because I was getting D minuses in physics and, you know, like bombing madly in calculus, you know. The thing that saved me was not my GPA. The thing that saved me was Mrs. Rosa Metesky, who was the head of the gifted and talented program, who meant, you know, was not a big school, and she knew a lot of the kids there, and she knew me, and she put me in the gifted and talented program, even though there's no way with my grades I should have gotten in there, but she knew that I was gifted and talented, and I was. But that was part of the problem, right? I was out of sync with what they wanted me to be gifted and talented on. And something which always has annoyed me, they expected that because I was extremely gifted in literature and English and history and music, that I was somehow supposed to be also equally gifted in math and science. And the answer is no, guys. Like, my aptitude is not math and science. My aptitude is English and history and music. And so the difference there was the program was broad enough that it could bring me in along a different axis. And it could say, this guy needs to be in the gifted program because he's gifted at this, not because he, you know, met this standardized metric. So I think you're 100% right that we need to cultivate the best and the brightest, but we need to make it much broader so we can get the best and the brightest from everything. There are 330 million people that live in this country. That is a huge number of people. We will get enough astronauts, enough engineers, we will get everyone that we could ever want if we broaden the programs and how these people are selected and not just along standardized testing lines. So I don't think we have to get rid of those programs. I just think we need to look at them a lot more broadly than just say, you got X test score, here we're going to kick you into this hopper so you can go into this thing. That's the problem. It's the
A European model or some other existing model exist that you think functions like significantly better than ours?
Yes, there are programs, for example, in Finland that function much better as an educational system, in part because they take kids seriously and because they listen to Sir Ken Robinson. Again, as I mentioned before, Sir Ken Robinson, one of the biggest losses I actually think of the last week was that. If you folks have a chance to look it up, I encourage every MepReport listener right after the show is done to go find this person on YouTube. There are tons of things because no one speaks more clearly, I think, and resonantly and powerfully about what needs to be done than this. His sort of takedown, I think Story would appreciate this, his takedown of the constant overprescribing of things like Ritalin, and he sort of literally like spaced it onto a map of the United States. So he's like, so apparently you're fine in the West Coast, and then as you get to the Midwest, you get a lot more kids that are ADD, and there's an epidemic that arrives on the East Coast, apparently. Like, it's hilarious because it's so stupid. So it's brilliant. So yes, Finland is an example like that. Frankly, a lot of European nations that focus more on kind of breadth of understanding than anything else. I was talking to a friend of mine from Germany who was talking about how there is a system of whether you get into, I forget the term for it, you know, the top level or the less top level, except what they did there, which is interesting, is there is literally
it's called the Champions League.
Yeah, exactly right. They're relegated. No, there is literally no stigma associated with not being in the one place. Like, it's just like, okay, cool. So then you get to do this. Like, it's not like, oh, well, okay, well, once you're done working at McDonald's, you know, it's not like that roll the eyes like thing that we get here, because so much of it is driven by our desire for self-worth and the totem pole of ranking ourselves above other people, right? It's not that way. So yes, there are systems, and particularly in Scandinavia, that do this far better. And I know a lot of people say, well, you can't compare the United States. But in education, yes, you can, because you don't have to educate all 330 million people at once. You have local school control. What needs to happen is federal established guidelines and then locally managed and organized execution of said guidelines, rather than people coming in and demanding certain kinds of standards which may work for the Northeast but don't work at all for the Southwest. And then on top of it, not giving them the funding they need. And then on top of it, also giving a bunch of private schools that already have money things that is draining, you know, people and resources from those public schools. So yes, I think there are absolutely other examples where this could happen, and it could be scaled easily. It could be scaled if, as Story said, we made different priorities. Like, that's honestly, to me, what I think is the most fascinating thing about this really awesome conversation. Thank you. This has really been great, seriously, is that it's so much of it is really what we prioritize. It really, like, and we can do it differently. Like, it's not just, oh, well, it's always going to be that way. No. We just set different priorities, you know, and we can do that, I think. He said.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, yeah. And you know what else?
What?
An hour has passed.
Oh.
Oh, I was going to start talking about the 2020 electoral politics for the first time after 2 hours.
Well, what a shock.
I kid. Clearly, that did not. Although I expected it to, because of all the news I've been reading all week. Like, I'm happy that we talked about what we did.
Oh my god, I'm actually really energized. This was awesome. I love this. I don't know whether people found it amusing, but I hope you found it interesting. Because, yeah, man, this is where it's at. I really, really enjoyed this a lot. So
I will nitpick and say one thing. We just went through two, you know, major party conventions, and they ain't no planning for the future. It's just the, like, please elect us, because the other side is our monsters, and there's no policy at all. And we
how
just
can you
about
plan
policy.
For the future when both horses are over 75? Like, there's they don't have a future. Why do they want anyone else to?
It was going so well. I want to thank everyone for listening.
Greg, like, just slowly fades out on the edit.
I'm like the Homer Simpson in the bush. Like, I'm just like,
yeah.
Back in the bush. This was awesome. If you folk likes what you heard, make sure you check us out at MepReport.com.
Outro.
No, I have outro. You know why I'm outroing? Because it's going to get us into another hour combo, and that's what I don't want to think. Instead, we're going to close the show and play some pub games. So you guys should do the same thing. Stay safe. You should. Okay, here's what we'll do. I already recommended one, Sir Ken Robinson. Go find him on YouTube. Russ, tell us someone that we should go find that will tell us how shitty all electoral politics are that you would recommend. Like, who's the person that they can find to depress them on YouTube?
They're all my favorite journalists who used to be progressive lefties and now just hate everything and are just, like, angry. Like, Matt Taibbi is a great example of just, like, just mocking everyone.
Angry guy. Yep.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay, so Matt Taibbi. So, Story, what about you? Who should they go find that you're like, go here? go on my Facebook feed, Story says.
Right,
people.
I know,
the
yeah.
Safe place.
Join my lovely cultivated debate on Facebook every day. you can see my electoral map, and that would be great. No, I think, you know who I like? Go on Bree Gray's Twitter feed. She was the Bernie's press secretary.
You like Bree Gray?
I love Bree Gray.
Oh no.
Yes, I love Bree Gray. She's a recent follow. She's amazing.
Greg, just think back to the first 90 minutes of the conversation.
Yeah, exactly. And we have deflated Greg. Tune in next time when we can build someone up and tear them down on the Mep Report.
Oh, say goodbye, everybody.
Hey, what, Kyle Rittenhouse, is that a thing that happened this week? I don't remember.
He was chasing a female he knew, as he shot past, I heard him say, she can't fly, but I'm telling you, she could run the pits of a kangaroo. She can't fly, but I'm telling you, she could run the pits of a kangaroo. Well, there is a moral to this ditty, da-da-da-da-da. Thrush can sing, but he ain't pretty, da-da-da-da-da. Duck can swim, but he can't sing, nor can the eagle on the wing. Emu can't fly, but I'm telling you, he can run the pants of a kangaroo. Well, the kookaburra laughed, and he said, it's true, da-da-da-da-da.